You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll get the details on how best to see what could be the most exciting meteor shower of the year.
First, steady rainfall and warm but not extreme temperatures are helping the corn crop develop. With similar conditions predicted over the next couple of weeks, experts say this year's corn crop could be a big one.
While it's still early to predict what the harvest might look like in the fall, these weather conditions could mean the country will have an overabundance of corn later this year. The combination of a bumper crop and low prices means potential financial losses for farmers for the second year in a row.
Mark Gold is with us now to talk about the corn crop and how it impacts farmers this year and for next season. He's managing partner at Top Third Ag Marketing, LLC. He's a regular guest on Iowa Public Television's Market to Market, a regular analyst on the U.S. Farm Report, and a former 20-year member of the Chicago Board of Trade. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, it seems maybe counterintuitive. A great year so far anyway for growing corn could ultimately be bad news for farmers. What are, assuming weather trends hold, what are farmers looking at by the end of the season?
Well, we're looking at near record crops. We might not have record yields, but with the amount of acres we planted in the ground, we're certainly looking at production somewhere north of 14.5 billion bushels of corn. And there are some early predictions out there for over 15 billion bushels. So we have a lot of corn, and this means that the carryouts, the amount of grain that will go into the bins unused, could approach 2.5 to 3 billion bushels, which is an awful lot of corn to be sitting in storage.
Now, prices, I understand, were already pretty low in recent years. Lots of corn means they'll probably stay low, maybe get lower. So I guess a question is, why was so much corn planted this year?
Well, farmers love to plant corn. They love to plant it, grow it, and harvest it. And they're counting on big yields to offset lower prices. So if a farmer produces, in general, 150 bushels to the acre, if he can get the right weather, he can go up to 200 bushels an acre, which makes a big difference in his net farm income. Now, if they've done a decent job of marketing, not only did they have good crops, but they're going to have good prices as well. The guys that didn't do the marketing are the guys that are going to be suffering this year.
Now, give us a little corn 101. First of all, how much of this corn we're talking about is stuff that I'm going to buy at the grocery store and eat myself versus might come to me in the form of a livestock product?
Well, the corn we're talking about is feed corn, which means it's going into livestock, chickens, swine, cattle, and none of it virtually will be consumed by the American public as a crop. The American consumer consumes sweet corn, not field corn. So the corn we see at Dominick's or Jewel is the corn that's grown mainly in the South, so it's ready for the 4th of July weekend, and that's the sweet corn we all know and love. The corn that the market is trading is the field corn that gets fed to livestock and exported around the world as a feed source.
So these low corn prices, bad news for farmers, but abundance of feed corn, low prices, does this mean good news for livestock operations and maybe for consumers when it comes to things like milk, meat, other products?
Absolutely. What's good for the farmer isn't necessarily good for the consumer and vice versa. So we've got cheap corn prices, which will help meat production at lower prices, milk production at lower prices, chicken, hogs, all of that. So that can be helpful for the American consumer. Now, are they going to really see that at the counter? You know, there's such a small part of the price that you see at the grocery store counter. It's such a small part of that is the grain input part of it. But it should make a little bit of a difference out here.
Talking to agriculture expert Mark Gold about a big crop predicted for corn, low prices, maybe bad news for farmers. Mark, when do farmers lock in on the price they're actually going to sell their corn for? As I, in my limited understanding, they're not going to wait till all the corn is ready, go out and find a buyer and find out what the price is. Is that right?
Well, generally, you know, for about 150 years of marketing, the American farmer was taught by his grandfather, who taught the son, who taught the grandson, don't sell the crop until you get it in the bin. There are ways to manage the risk long before harvest, but farmers were always very skittish about selling something that they didn't know was actually going to be there, whether because of drought or hail or whatever the circumstances. But now in today's marketing environment, they have insurance which guarantees them so many bushels to market. So we're seeing more and more farmers looking ahead and trying to price crops well before harvest, which is generally the best time to look at marketing your grain.
Now, at the start of the growing season, when farmers are making the decision of what to plant, what kind of predictions were we seeing for the weather this year? Was it thought that this is going to be a great year for growing corn?
Well, unfortunately, there were all too many of these weather gurus out there that were predicting a record drought, record heat in July, and corn yields taking a big tumble. And a lot of farmers didn't want to sell anything because they were so worried about this drought. As it turned out, we've had near-perfect conditions. We have great genetics on the seeds which grow the corn, and we're looking at possibly record yields along with big acres out here. So these forecasts, which turned out to be totally incorrect, prevented a lot of farmers from doing the right thing.
What would have been the right thing in that situation, do you think?
Well, for us, what we had recommended to our clients, we had a nice rally in corn from 360 up to 440 a bushel. We were certainly advising them to go ahead and make what we call cash forward sales so they could lock in the price at the elevator for delivery in November. And we also suggested that they use what's called a put option, which is like an insurance policy that they can buy to protect the higher prices. If prices go to $5 or $6 a bushel, they'll lose 20 cents a bushel for that insurance policy, but if prices collapse as they have, then they can be protected with that higher-priced insurance policy. So there were things to do, and the farmers did have an opportunity, but many of them were too scared to take advantage of it because of these dire forecasts.
A lot of farmers locked into selling this corn now at what looks like it's going to be low prices. How bad a news is it for farmers around the Midwest, Mark? Is this dire? Are a lot of people going to be going out of business? Or is this, you know, a blip, a bad hit, something they could bounce back from next season?
Well, it all depends on how their credit and financial condition is and the relationship like with their agricultural lender. We've had at harvest two fairly cheap prices out here last year and this year. They withstood the first year. The second year now, if they haven't done the marketing and if prices do move lower through harvest, they're looking at selling grain well under the cost of production. Now, if they put money away, if they've got a good relationship with their ag lender, there will be, you know, plenty of money available for these guys. The guys where it's really tight and haven't had a marketing plan and are operating at big losses will have more trouble this year than past years obtaining capital to run their farms.
I wonder, looking ahead, does it make sense for a farmer who's primarily doing feed corn maybe next year to think, okay, I'm still going to mostly do that, I'm going to hedge with a more variety of crops, or do the economies of scale militate toward, no, stick with as much feed corn as you can get in that situation?
Well, one of the things that farmers look at is what they call a crop rotation. They generally don't like to put corn and corn and corn year after year on the same fields because it depletes a lot of the nutrients out of the soil. So they will generally have what's called a 50-50 rotation with soybeans. Now, when soybean prices get incredibly high, will they shift more acres to beans and less to corn? Yeah, they will. But for the most part, farmers like to plant corn. They'll pretty much stick with their rotations. And again, if we get the corn in the ground in a timely fashion next year, then we're looking at another potentially big crop. My guess is, so many times when these forecasters all gang up and talk about a drought in a specific year, a lot of times it's the next year that the drought hits. So you have to consider that Mother Nature takes care of excesses and takes care of surpluses as well.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
That's Mark Gold, managing partner at Top Third Ag Marketing LLC. Join us to talk about what looks like a bumper corn crop and how it'll affect farmers.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few moments, we'll get the details on how best to see what could be the most exciting meteor shower of the year.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Abe Lincoln may draw all the photos from eager grads on UW-Madison's Bascom Hill, but there's a plaque nearby with a message that forms a sort of mission statement for the campus. Writer Robert Kennedy tells us about the trip that brought sifting and winnowing into focus in his own life.
High on the list of antiquities salvaged from my undergraduate years are the words sifting and winnowing. The plaque where I first read them on the UW-Madison campus claimed it was all one needed to find the truth. I'd learned about sifting from watching my mother bake, but winnowing remained a mystery until my wife's 90-year-old grandmother asked for my help. We were harvesting popcorn, a staple on their family's farm near Montello. Pointing to an oversized roaster full of kernels, Grandma Stelter said we needed to winnow the corn. At her direction, I poured the kernels into a pail. As they fell, the useless hulls disappeared into the wind. My 13-year-old son, Joel, knows something about popcorn, but little of other essentials or how to separate them from the rest. So when we began to think about taking a trip one summer, the lessons from the farm and my college days came drifting back. We planned a June hike along the Ice Age Trail in the southern unit of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine State Forest. Over 6 days, we'd cover 42 miles. For days, we bothered with what to wear and what to eat. But in the end, it came down to what we could do without. The rainfly for the tent was one thing. Our stretch of trail has Adirondack shelters at each of three designated campsites. Another would be the world of electronic media and connections. As is often true in life, we would have only ourselves. Our routine was simple enough. In the morning, still sleepy and sore, we'd breakfast on instant oatmeal and coffee. During the day, we ran on beef jerky, granola bars, and peanut butter bagels. Actually, it was water that fueled us, and lots of it. Once evening came, relieved of packs and heavy boots, we could rest and relax. With only the steady roar of a gas stove to replace the trappings of modern life, time would meander. The distance of a few days had put the overstuffed world far behind, and in the fading twilight, the simple pleasure of a warm meal was a welcome delight. All right, supper was usually freeze-dried and eaten so hungrily that we scalded our mouths on its still chewy texture. But even so, it was as gourmet as it would get, and we ate it eagerly. Once our few dishes were done, we'd crawl into the tent. I might read a chapter from a book, but more often we would simply stare into the blackness of the tent ceiling, feeling each other's thoughts and savoring our own. Trekking tends to shift priorities, and nearly always brings the traveler home feeling lighter than when he left. Like the hulls of corn, non-essentials disappear with the wind, as payments and schedules give way to the demands of gear and the comfort of dry socks. A brief avenue of shade and a forest interlude graciously pays for an hour in the hot sun, and the time idled away on an overlook, where you only stop for lunch, turns out to be the reason you made the trip in the first place. What I learned from that plaque of long ago is that the lessons that really matter can't always be put into words. Sifting and winnowing and the search for truth. Reason enough to pack light and travel a wilderness.
Robert Kennedy is a writer in Oconomowoc. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now we'll look at one of the coolest celestial events of the year that we can actually see from here on Earth. The annual Perseid meteor shower is officially underway, and during its peak, experts say this year's show could be even more spectacular than usual.
Here with us now to talk about the meteor shower and how best to see it is Bob Bonader. He's the director of the Daniel M. Sorif Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
So first off, what's actually happening in the sky that causes us to see this spectacular display every year?
Well, what's happening is our planet Earth orbits the sun, right? And these comets leave a bunch of debris, other comets, and then we simply orbit through this debris field. And it's these little dust grains from the comet falling through our atmosphere very fast, mind you, that creates the shooting star.
I understand. I keep hearing this is going to be a good Perseid, Bob, and I hear it has something to do with Jupiter, maybe, and I don't understand why.
Well, Jupiter is it's a big gas giant, right? And it actually has more mass than all of the other planets put together. And what it's doing out there, its big gravity is pulling these dust grains from the comet more into our orbital path, the Earth's path. So Jupiter is affecting this debris, and that's going to make a better meteor shower, hopefully.
And the Perseids go over a few days. What's the span of it this year, and when is it expected to peak?
It's expected to peak the night of August the 11th, the morning of the 12th, though, is better. If it's a tall order, but if people can get up early and get away from streetlights, and if it's clear, they're going to be they're going to see a heck of a show.
Talking about the Perseid meteor shower with Bob Bonadour from the Milwaukee Public Museum. He directs the planetarium there. Okay, Bob, we've stocked up on bug spray. I think that's going to be key to this. Where do we look in the sky to see the Perseids?
Oh, this is the easiest part. Just get a blanket, lawn chair, lie on your back, and look up. And it's, of course, better to do it with friends and family, and then you can start counting them, right? One, did you see that? And you just look all over, because the human eyes can only cover about 20-25% of the sky. So that's why if you're with friends or family, you can see everything.
And so we can see them with the naked eye, but is there any benefit in bringing along a telescope or other visual aid?
Not really. This is the time to give that a break. The sky's always great through a telescope too, but this, for a meteor shower, just line your back and look up.
And cities really are a problem to see something like this. All the light makes it really hard to see these meteors, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. And just getting away from the streetlights on any night besides a meteor shower is worth your effort, because the stars are just gorgeous and against the black velvet of night. And now get away from the streetlights if you can. Make a night of it. Do the night picnic, pack your beverages and food and just have a great time.
So you said late night on the 11th or morning, and I'm thinking you're saying very, very, very early morning on the 12th. Kind of what hours, if people are going to get themselves, either stay up or get themselves out of bed, what hours will they get the most bang for their buck?
Best hours would be a couple hours before dawn. Sunrise is about 6 o'clock here in eastern Wisconsin. Just if you're up by 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and for those couple hours before the dawn hits, should be great. Those are the best times. Or any time after midnight, if you can stay up that late, try to stay up a couple hours after midnight. The reason the morning sky is better is because the Earth is now, you're facing the way that the Earth is orbiting the sun. It's kind of a strange analogy is if you're driving in a car, you're always going to see more bugs on the front of your windshield than the back of your windshield, right?
Right.
Okay, so after midnight, we're now turning, now we're looking out the front windshield. Before midnight, we're looking out the back windshield. So that's why if you get up early, it's much better.
Now, Bob, I've been foiled in years past. I'm on a vacation. I'm in a remote place. Great. It's August. I'm going to see stars. I'm going to see the Perseids. And I get out at night, and there's the full moon. It's beautiful, and it's bright, and I can't see anything else hardly. Where's the moon as the Perseids peak?
The moon sets a little before 1 o'clock, so it's perfect. And that's by the time the meteor shower starts. We'll start ramping up is right around that time. So the moon will be done. That's great. And try to douse any other lights you have around you. Just get away from them.
Now we hear about the Perseids about this time every year. Are there other regular meteor showers at other times of the year that we should maybe put on our calendars?
The other one we always recommend is the Geminids in December, about 12th, 13th of December. But, of course, it's very cold those months. But that's why the Perseids are always great. It's August. It's beautiful. But the Geminids is the other big one in December.
Although no mosquitoes in December.
Right, exactly.
Well, I want to talk about what we're actually seeing. When I think meteor, I'm thinking this big chunk of space stuff. Really, though, it sounds like this is dust. This is tiny debris making these splashes of light, right?
Right, very tiny, mostly dust grains. Think of a grain of sand at a beach. Try to hold one grain of sand. That's pretty small. And the brighter ones, of course, are pebble-sized or a little bigger. And, yeah, they're very small, but there's lots of them, and the key is the speed. They're traveling through the atmosphere at 20 to 40 miles per second. And it's not so much the little dust grain burning up, it's the heating of the atmosphere that you're seeing. That's the streak also. That's 95% of it is the heating of the atmosphere, not so much the rock burning up.
Are there any other big astronomical events on the horizon, one might say?
Well, all the planets are in the evening sky right now, all five visible planets, and that's a treat, though a couple, Mercury and Venus, are pretty low in the western horizon. But over the next few nights, Thursday and Friday here, you can use the moon to guide your eye. The moon will be a nice sliver crescent moon over in the west, and it'll pass by Mercury tomorrow night and Jupiter on Friday night.
And do we have any hot eclipse action coming up anytime soon, Bob?
Oh, I'm 382 days away. Not that I'm counting.
Oh.
It's actually next August. We're getting ready for the huge, big solar eclipse that's going to sweep across America. The first one to do that in 99 years. We're doing a lecture tomorrow night here at the Planetarium at the Public Museum, which is also our Thank You Thursday, Kohl's Thank You Thursday. The museum is free, so come on down, see the lecture, see the museum. And this eclipse, you don't want to miss this eclipse. It's your best chance. It's not going to be total here in Milwaukee. We're leading a little trip down to the St. Louis area. But total solar eclipses, I've been doing this stuff for a while. They are the most awesome sky sight you can see.
Yeah, it seems like they keep being in the news, but not here. Or, you know, it's on the wrong side of the planet,
right?
When it's daylight.
If you don't leave Milwaukee, you have to wait till 2099, just to give you an idea. It'll be a long time, but there's one happening next August 21st, 2017, and we're excited about it.
Well, as we wrap up, Bob, what kind of programs do you have at the Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum?
Well, we do Wisconsin stargazing every day here at the Planetarium at the museum, and we're featuring the meteor shower, of course, right now. And we have a show about the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, talking about rocks from space. You know, that was the big rock that hit us 66 million years ago. And so we have a great show on that. And we're getting ready for a cool exhibit called Hidden Wisconsin in the museum coming up in October. So lots of stuff always going on here.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Bob Bonador, director of the Daniel M. Soroff Planetarium at the Public Museum. He joined us to talk about this year's Perseid meteor shower.
Coming up, there was a time when U.S. presidents, by and large, were trusted implicitly by a lot of the population. What changed? We'll talk to the author of the book, Why Presidents Fail. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Snap Judgment. Get ready, America. It's time to celebrate ourselves. Put on your sunglasses and open up the fire hydrants for the Snap Judgment Summer Special. Amazing stories about people making America their home. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First,
late yesterday, I canceled a carefully planned operation which was underway in Iran to position our rescue team for a later withdrawal of American hostages who've been held captive there since November 4th.
Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
Katrina exposed serious problems in our response capability at all levels of government. And to the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility.
The challenge has been just making sure that consumers are actually able to get on a website, see those choices, and shop. And I think that we probably underestimated the complexities of building out a website that needed to work the way it should. There is a larger problem that I probably speak personally, but also as the administration, could have identified earlier, and that is the way the federal government does procurement.
That was President Jimmy Carter talking about the failed rescue attempt in Iran, President George W. Bush first complimenting the head of FEMA during Hurricane Katrina and then admitting later that relief efforts fell short, and finally President Obama discussing the failure of the Affordable Care Act website rollout.
Presidential failures are nothing new. They aren't the domain of one party or the other, and they can happen on issues as different as wars, natural disasters, and policy decisions. The question is, what leads to those failures, and how can future presidents avoid those pitfalls?
Joining us to talk about the common elements of presidential failures and what future presidents can do to avoid them is Elaine Kmark. She's an adjunct lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings Institution and the director of their Center for Effective Public Management. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Elaine, you lay out three key steps of governing well for presidents: policy, communication, and implementation. Can you give us an example of those three steps in relation to a particular issue?
Of course. The first thing I'd say is those three steps are equal in importance to good government or, frankly, to good leadership. And let's take the first example that you cited there, which was the failure of the Iranian hostage rescue back in 1980. They had come to the end of the road on negotiation. There was really, you know, they hadn't really nowhere to turn. And so a military option seemed very likely and probably a pretty good idea, although there were some notable dissenters. Communicating it was a no-brainer because Americans were terribly concerned in 1980 about the fate of those hostages. But in that instance, implementation was everything. And one of the themes that runs through the book, Why Presidents Fail, is that recently American presidents don't have enough interaction with and knowledge of the government that they run. And the consequence of that is that they fail on the third step. They fail to adequately implement the decisions that they make.
One of the challenges that all new presidents face is inheriting the behemoth bureaucracy that is the federal government plus the military on top of that. How big a factor is that in setting presidents up for success or, in many cases, failure?
Well, that's a great question because that's really at the core of the analysis. The good thing about the modern federal government is that almost at any point in time, somebody in the behemoth of the government, as you said, knows the answer that you're looking for. The bad thing is, of course, it costs us a lot of money. And also, presidents, it's so big that presidents have a hard time knowing what works and where to look for things. This has gotten increasingly the case as the government has gotten bigger. Presidents have become consumed with talking and messaging at the expense of understanding the government that they run. And it blows up on them when they put in the hands of certain agencies important missions, and then the missions fail. In all the instances I talk about in the book, the warning signs about implementation problems were present for sometimes for decades before the president decided how to implement something. And they were knowable. And therefore, my plea in the book is to ask presidents to pay attention to their government and try to reduce at least the probability of failure.
Well, and just to make that even more complex, the two parties have defined themselves and each other in terms of how they each view the structure and purpose of government. How would you describe each party's position and how that impacts their ability to lead and to succeed?
Well, both parties really are at fault here because they both operate with stereotypes. The Republican Party starts with the proposition that the whole darn thing is a mess, a waste of money, and that everybody in the government is incompetent. The Democrats start with the assumption that we're not spending enough, we should spend some more, and all the people in the government will automatically do whatever the president wants and have it done right. Neither is obviously correct because the government is so big that at any given point in time, something in the federal government is going very right and something is going very wrong. So take the last example you used of the failed websites during Obamacare. The president there ends up saying there's something wrong with the way the federal government procures information technology. Well, literally, 6 weeks after he said that, two astronauts walked in space and for 5 hours, tethered to the space station, repaired a cooling pump on the space station, miles above the Earth. The technology that allowed them to do that, from the spacesuits to the space station itself, were bought by the federal government in exactly the same way that the technology to set up the websites were. Federal bureaucrats at NASA contracted with people who make spacesuits and with Boeing, which makes the giant, space station. So it is a perfect example of how within literally 6 weeks of each other, the government could completely screw up in one part and perform what's really close to a miracle in another part. And that's why it's important for presidents to understand what the capacities are in their government.
We're talking right now with Elaine Kmark. She's director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, and her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What presidential failures stand out in your memory? Can you imagine a way that those situations could have been handled better by the president in question? What would the next president need to do to gain and keep your trust? And how can a president, how could an administration bounce back from a big failure like the ones we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Elaine Kmark. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as some of the greatest presidential failures or successes? What led to failure or success in that case? How could things have been handled better? Do you work for the federal government? What works well? What could be improved in the way a president manages that fairly large organization? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And Elaine, you say that one common failure of presidents is to not understand the capacity of the people and agencies that are under them. Can you give us a particularly striking example of that?
Yeah. One of the things I talk about in the book is the scandals at the Veterans Administration during Obama's second term. The fact is that even in the transition from Bush to Obama, there were warning signs that things were not going well at the Veterans Administration. There were government reports on it. There were stories about it. A lot was out there to indicate that this was a troubled agency. It was having a hard time coping with all the new business from the Afghan-Iraq vets. They had new mandates, but not necessarily enough new money. Things were getting to a crisis point. And yet, when the story blew up, the president and the president's people were clearly surprised. They seemed to not have anticipated this. And yet, people had known it for many years before. So that is the kind of thing that maybe a president should start paying attention to when they come into office. Where's the trouble in this great big thing called the federal government? What do they do and what do they know? And where are the trouble signs?
In the montage that we heard at the start of this segment, both former President George W. Bush and President Obama referred to themselves as being more or less one and the same as their administration, and as a result, needing to take responsibility for government failures. Is that a reasonable expectation of a president?
Well, that's the interesting thing about government, about presidential failure. You know, nobody expects President Obama to write code. Nobody expected George H. Bush to, you know, deliver water and ice to the city of New Orleans. Nobody expected President Carter to fly the helicopters into the desert. So I don't mean that they obviously don't have the direct responsibility for the mission. But what they do have is they have the responsibility for placing the mission in an organization that is capable of doing it. And that's a place where they have continually fallen down on the job. And that's one of the things I think that they could do to improve the probability of success as opposed to failure.
Let's go to the phones. And Jack in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Hi.
Jimmy Carter, I liked him as president, but one thing where I think he made a mistake was picking Paul Volcker as the head of the Federal Reserve. And when the press asked him why he did it, he said to appease the business community. Hmm. Yeah, well, he appeased the business community, all right. But what he also hurt Carter's chances of beating Reagan in 1980. He jacked up the interest rates, I think, as high as 20%.
And thanks for that call, Jack. Elaine, so it sounds like part of it was how the decision was communicated.
Yeah, part of that was how the decision was communicated. And I think that the caller is definitely onto something. I mean, one of the things that the two things really hurt President Carter's reelection in 1980. One was the failure of the Iranian hostages, which was a military failure. And the other was the poor economy, which was at the time, you know, really hobbled by both high interest rates and high unemployment. I'm not sure that you can put all of that at Paul Volcker's feet, but clearly the stewardship of the economy was as big a problem for Jimmy Carter as the failure of the rescue mission.
Elaine, it does seem like there was a time in the past when U.S. presidents had maybe not complete trust of the American public, but kind of trust until given a reason not to trust. Was that mm-hmm. really the case, or is that just a case of us thinking back to non-existent good old days?
No, that's verifiable. Gallup and other polling organizations began asking the question way back in the late 50s, early 60s. Do you trust the federal government to do the right thing? Always, most of the time, sometimes, and never. And that line of trust has gone down over successive generations, regardless of the party in power, regardless of the state of the economy. It's just been on a free fall. And part of it, I think, is that our parents and grandparents saw presidents and a federal government that got us out of the Great Depression, won the war against the Nazis and against Japan, and, you know, basically were successful at doing what they said they were going to do. Starting in the 70s with Vietnam, we begin to encounter a series of governmental failures. And you can track that exactly with the amount of trust that people lack in the current federal government.
And Elaine, the title of your book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. And I want to zero in on that second half. In your study of public management and the functioning of the government at the federal level, What do you think is the single most important thing for future presidents to do in order to succeed in winning the public's trust?
I think they have to stop talking and start governing. I think they spend way too much of their precious time doing one, as they call it, message event. That's what we called it in the White House, and they still call it that. One message event after another. And what they don't spend any time doing is thinking through the policy, not just from the inception, because most of them think seriously about policy, not just the communication, but the third step they let go. Who's going to implement this? What organization in the government is going to do it? How's that organization doing? Does that organization have the ability to do what we're asking them to do? And so my plea in this book is that our next president, whoever he or she is, spends more time on the business of government. And the reason that's so important is that once you get into one of these messes, like the ones you illustrated at the beginning of this segment, no speech in the world can get you out of trouble. Doesn't matter how eloquent you are, what a great communicator you are. If you're in a mess and the websites don't work or the helicopters crash, you can't talk your way out of that. And I think that one of the things that happens to presidents is they go from campaigning and they kind of keep campaigning. And they often miss the fact that once they're in office, it's reality that matters, what they can actually deliver.
Well, Elaine, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you, and I think we'll want to check in with you when we know who that next president might be.
Sounds like a good idea.
That was Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at Brookings Institution and Director of their Center for Effective Public Management. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. And you can weigh in on this question about presidential failures and successes and trusting the federal government on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. By the way, you can participate in an Ideas Network survey. We'd love to have your feedback on the Ideas Network. You'll find a survey on our website at WPR.org/survey. Tell us how you listen, why you listen at WPR.org/survey, and thank you for listening.
The district attorneys from Wisconsin's largest counties have a lot in common this year. Both are pursuing an appeal at the U.S. Supreme Court of a John Doe investigation involving Governor Walker's campaign. They also both face Democratic primary challenges. In our first of two segments on the DA's races, WPR's Chuck Kornbach reports on Milwaukee County DA John Chisholm and challenger Verona Swanigan.
Chisholm is running for his fourth term. He's gained national attention for leading two John Doe investigations into friends and political colleagues of Scott Walker and of the governor himself. The Wisconsin Supreme Court halted the second investigation into allegations of illegal campaign finance coordination. But Chisholm rejects the claim that the probe was excessive.
My position has always been that at the end of the day, citizens are best served by a government that isn't influenced by disguised, hidden, large amounts of money that come from unknown sources, but very wealthy sources. And that's introduced something into politics that I think is very harmful.
Chisholm's opponent, Verona Swanigan, is a criminal defense attorney. She says from what she can tell, Chisholm took the second Doe probe too far.
You know why I believe he did? Because the one thing I have to base it off of is what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court, I did read their 300-some-odd page opinion, and it basically said that he didn't even have probable cause for half of the people that he went after.
A conservative group targeted in John Doe 2 is spending money on ads attacking Chisholm, but Swanigan says she didn't know of the group's leader, Eric O'Keefe, until recently. Swanigan contends she'd be tougher on crime than the incumbent DA. She says she's a conservative Democrat, not a Republican. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee.
And I'm Laurel White in Madison, where Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan faces a primary challenge from longtime Kenosha County District Attorney Bob Jambois. Ozanne was the first African-American district attorney in Wisconsin's history when he was appointed to the position by then-Governor Jim Doyle in 2010. He ran unopposed in 2012. This year, in his first ever challenged election for the seat, he's armed with a slew of high-profile endorsements. He outlined them during a candidate forum in Madison this week.
City of Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi, Wisconsin Senator Fred Rister, Wisconsin Senator Mark Miller, Wisconsin Representative Melissa Sargent.
Opponent Bob Jambois is flying in the face of that establishment support. A former Kenosha County District Attorney, Jambois says Ozanne is falling down on the job when it comes to leadership and office management. Here's how he describes his first days working in Ozanne's office as an assistant district attorney in 2015.
The Dane County District Attorney's office was demoralized. It was dysfunctional, and it was disorganized.
Jambois also points to a large number of attorneys leaving the office as proof of that dysfunction. Ozanne pushes back, saying those departures are due to poor funding levels.
Realize when people leave our office, they get an increase in pay, $20,000 to $30,000, and less work.
Aside from the back and forth on work environment, the candidates largely agree on policy issues. They both support expanding restorative justice programs and providing more early intervention services to children living in poverty. There's no Republican candidate in the race, so whoever wins the Democratic primary on August 9th will serve a four-year term as Dane County District Attorney. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.